Hey everybody, this week on the podcast, a very, very funny producer, writer, director, comedian, John Rigi, a friend of mine who is also working with me in developing my life story for a TV show. We're doing that along with Don Scardino, a great director who's going to be a guest on my podcast very soon. John started out as a stand-up out of the Midwest and has made appearances on The Tonight Show and has been a writer and producer on some of the biggest comedy shows, The Larry Sanders Show, The Comeback on HBO, 30 Rock, where he did a lot of work. He's got some really great stories about working on 30 Rock, working with Alec Baldwin, Tracy Morgan, and just how TV gets made. He's the guy that makes TV shows. He's the guy who you see at the beginning of the show that says created by or executive produced by. This is like one of the guys in Hollywood that makes TV in a big way. So I wanted you to get to understand what people like that do and how they bring TV to you and just hear how funny John is. So it was a really fun conversation. I am in Los Angeles. You can see me here in LA. Check out my website, paulmercurio.com, for tour dates. Keep spreading the links around for these podcasts. We're building and building, and this is a really great one and a really, really interesting guy and super funny guy. So I want people to hear it and pick up my CD. It's not me, it's the world, at my website, paulmercurio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's podcast. I'm sitting here with an extremely talented, extremely funny gentleman who has fabulous shoes on, Mr. John Rigi, comedian, television writer, producer, show creator.
And cobbler.
Cobbler. he's like an evil villain. He's licking a candy pop, a See's candy pop. It looks sort of like an evil villain a little bit with the shaved head.
See's candy, if we could get some of those off of this, that would be great. I love them, See's candy.
John and I are, you know, working on an idea along with another great guy, Don Scardino, a director who couldn't be here today because he's at playing the ponies. Supposedly he's at work, but I don't think he is.
And got a liquor problem, too.
And John started as a stand-up and has been writer, producer, executive producer on a bunch of shows, including 30 Rock, where he got to know Don Scardino. Mm-hmm. And thank you for being here at your office while I interview you.
It was a terrible, terrible inconvenience.
Commute to go from the desk to the couch.
For me, I had to walk 8 feet. To get here.
I've been wanting to ask you about this bike. You have an orange bike in your office. Do you bike to work?
I don't bike to work. I bike on the lot because, and when I was, when we had our show in production, I would bike around quite a bit between the sound stages. But now the show isn't on, so the air is coming out of the tires. And I don't use it. But
that was a super fun night show.
Super fun night. And also we have a cart now, so.
Now, what happened with the Super Fun Night? Why didn't that go? sorry.
How much tape have you got in that thing?
this is electronic, man.
Digital, Grandpa.
We can go all day.
Why, change the canister, and I'll tell you a story.
Explain to people the process of developing a show. What I like to do on my show is to introduce my listeners to people at different walks of life who do what they do, and you're at the top of the profession. You write, create shows. You've been an actor and a comedian as well. But the process of creating quickly a show, pitching it, getting it on TV, and then why you failed at it. come on, that was a joke, right?
Yeah, you know, I got it. I'm fascinated by your gym bag because it's like a little tiny gym bag for like a little tiny basketball player. It's like literally miniature size. Like if LeBron James was like just this tall, like 3.5 feet, he could wear that gym bag and it would look normal. Less, maybe like 2 feet. Okay.
I do keep a headband in here and sneakers just in case. In case I run into a small person and I want to dominate them on the court.
I think you just carry that bag and go, don't fuck with me. Look how tall I am. I'm a giant.
It'd be good if it had a shoulder strap.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a picture of that.
How does it happen? Well, in that particular case,
we're at the Warner Brothers lot, and you have a production deal here with the Warner Brothers Studios. So that means you're very good, and they wanted you, and they give you millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Right. Also, they're listening.
Oh.
They're listening right now. It's bugged. In the particular case of Super Fun Night was a pilot that was written by Rebel Wilson that was taken out by Rebel Wilson after she had done the first Pitch Perfect movie. And there was a lot of interest in Rebel because she had, that movie was a big movie for her, and so a lot of people wanted to work with her. And so ABC and CBS got into a bidding war on the script, and ABC won, or CBS won. I know the story very well. CBS won. So they did the show as a multi-camera show, which means that there's a live audience there, and it's kind of like what you like Friends and those kinds of shows are multi-camera shows.
Mm-hmm.
So basically
that means a live studio audience.
Live studio audience.
It's a little bit brighter and
right.
Yeah, as opposed to single camera
like where 30 Rock, like
a, right, where it looks
which
like
is
a film, right?
More filmy. So they did this single camera version of it, and afterwards CBS decided not to pick the show up. And
do they ever tell you, I mean, I know the answers, but for the listeners, do they ever tell you why they don't pick it up? Which is hard because
no, they don't ever really tell you why.
And that's got to be frustrating, right?
They also don't tell you why they do pick it up. So it's just, it's all a mystery. It's not even sure. You just don't question. You just drink until you hear. But, and also, by the way, I was not involved in any of this of what I'm telling you about. This is all way before I mm-hmm. came on. So then, magically, CBS actually gave up the property and gave it to ABC for money, a payment, for sure. But they got it away from CBS. Now, that alone doesn't happen very often. And honestly, again, why that happened, why CBS was willing to give it up, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But they did. So then ABC wanted it, but ABC said, we want it, but we want it as a single camera show. So no audience, shot more like a film, that kind of thing. And that's where I came in. So they were, my studio, Warner Brothers, was looking for a showrunner. And they said to me, would you, I had seen the pilot. And I honestly was like, you know, it's funny, but it's not my thing. And I just, not interested, so I'll pass. That's I saw the CBS multicam version. And then when it was up for grabs and ABC got it, they said, they revisited me and asked me about it again, and I said, I'm really kind of don't think I'm the right person for Rebel. And they said, well, would you just sit down and talk to her for like 20 minutes? And so I had a meeting with her. And I was very taken by her, and she's a very formidable presence and really funny. And I thought, well, maybe we can. Maybe if we do make this a multi-cam or a single-cam show, maybe we can make it into something. And what really ultimately drew me to it was the idea of putting three women on air that normally would not be on air. Because you couldn't, they're all very attractive ladies in their own way. But I don't think that even they would say they're not attractive in the sort of cookie-cutter,
traditional,
here's what a woman is supposed to look like way. And I liked that we were going to showcase these three women who maybe weren't the ones who were picked to go to prom or asked to go to prom or anything like that and do a show about them. So I really liked that element of it. What went wrong was a couple of things.
And if you don't want to say you don't, I don't want to compromise.
No, anything. I'll say this. What went wrong, part of what went wrong was there were a lot of things that make a show work and a lot of things that make a show not work. And one of the things that made that show not work was that I really think that Rebel was on the wrong network. And with all due respect to ABC, because I think they're great and they're great at what they do, but they do kind of much more kind of what I would say sort of more family kind of comedies.
Right.
And Rebel is a much more edgy comic, and she has a edge to her, and she likes to push the envelope quite a bit. And I think that they kind of had a hard time both getting on the same page as to what the show should be. So, you know, I think it was, you know, there's a lot of things about it that I'm really proud of, and obviously a lot of things about it that I wish we could do over again and get a second swing at.
Yeah. When you were on 30 Rock, I mean, you've been a writer, and then what you typically do on Scripted Half Hours is you sort of move up the ranks, you're producer, co-executive producer, executive producer, when you reach that level. How do responsibilities differ and change as you sort of move up the ranks from writer to producer to executive producer to essentially show running the show, and dealing with talent in that capacity and like how crazy talent can be?
Well, you know, on a multi-camera show, like when I was on Will and Grace, I was a co-executive producer on Will and Grace, but I was by no means the showrunner. And in a weird sort of way, a multi-camera show doesn't really need a lot of hands on deck in that way, like dealing with talent and stuff like that, because on a multicam show, basically you rehearse every day for 4 or 5 days, whatever it is, 4 days. It's a 4-day shoot week. So you rehearse, the actors come in, they work with the director, they rehearse for 2 or 3 hours, maybe a little longer. You watch a run-through with the other writers, you see what works, you see what doesn't work, you go back upstairs and you write. Show night, you shoot the show. And that's really where the showrunners, even the showrunners, aren't really in there like dealing with talent or or anything like that, because it's all sort of happening so fast, like it's all being shot in that one night. A single camera show is like a movie, and you shoot every single day, and you shoot for 12 to 14 hours a day, and somebody has to be on the set dealing with things that happen on the floor and happen with the actors. Sometimes actors have questions about the scene. Sometimes actors don't want to say a line in a particular way. Sometimes actors,
how do you deal with that? Like, do you just eventually kind of give in because the actor has to deliver it? Do you ever have an incident, funny or otherwise, where you're just like, look, do it this way or whatever? Like, if you...
Well, I never... I always found that, like, with a really good actor like Alec Baldwin, if you could give him a reason for the line being there, like the thinking behind the line.
Can you give me an example of something that you did with him?
I can't, but I can give you an example of where I didn't have one. Was with Elaine Stritch.
Who's also, I understand, fairly demanding actress and knows what she wants.
She's a tough bird, yeah. But I loved her. But, and I think I might have told you the story before, but basically the first time she was on, she was my problem from the time we got to 30 Rock. I became her handler because I was the one who suggested her, and then I was the one who, when we sent her the script and she phoned back and said, I've got a lot of questions. And so Tina said, Rigi, get in a cab and go talk to her. So I went up to the Carlisle and I met her. I had never met her before. And I became like Elaine's go-to person, and
you immediately hit it off with her.
I liked her a lot.
Yeah,
she was tough, but I liked her a lot. Yeah. I thought she was. First of all, I couldn't even believe I was getting to work with her because she's just such a. She was just one of the last ones.
Yeah,
you know. And I know. Yeah, I mean, we won't see another of her kind coming down the pike, I don't think, ever.
Broadway trained, right? Started as in theater,
yeah,
and...
Yeah. From Detroit, moved to New York, became a Broadway actress. Amazing, amazing career. And tough as nails. But we did the end of the first season on 30 Rock. We did an episode where Jack had a heart attack. And Elaine was supposed to say, Colleen,
is her character, Jack's mom, wouldn't go into the hospital room to see Jack. She was afraid. She didn't like hospitals.
I remember that.
So Liz was going to go in instead. And so as Tina was walking down the hall, Elaine was supposed to say, "Tell my boy I love him, but not in a queer way." So we rehearse, and she comes up to me, and she says, "John, I don't want to say that. I don't want to say in a queer way. That's insulting to homosexuals. I don't want to say queer." So, literally, she's standing on the other side of a counter like a... We're in an actual hospital. It wasn't a set. We found this old abandoned hospital in Queens somewhere. And we were in this hospital, and she was standing on, like, the other side of, like, the nurse's station. And she said that. She walked up and said that to me. And then Tina was, like, downwind, like, 10 feet. And she was just looking at me like, "Do something." I had nothing. I had nothing. So I said, and this was not true, I said, "Oh, Elaine, when we said queer, I don't think we meant queer like gay. I think we meant queer like weird. Like, don't be weird about it. Like, you know how people say, 'Oh, that's so queer, like weird.' So that's what I think we meant. I think we just meant, like, don't say it in, like, a weird way." And I remember she looked at me. I remember she, like, was carrying her purse, and she was in her fur, and she was wearing that ermine hat, white man's shirt, tie. And I remember she just, like, readjusted everything. Like, her purse. Mm-hmm. And she just kind of straightened her, before she answered, straightened her coat, and she was like, "Uh-huh, uh-huh," fixing her hat. And then she said, "John, let's you and I get something straight. You don't bullshit me, and I won't break you in half."
That's awesome.
And so then I said, "You're right, Elaine. I don't have anything." I said, I didn't have anything else. I said, "Can you just give me one? Can you just do it once?" And she's like, "I'll say it once, but then I'm changing it." And she did. But as we as writers always say, all you need is one time.
Right.
And we got it.
Right.
And we used it. But she didn't want to do it. But there's an instance where I didn't have I had no reason. We wanted to say queer. Don't be faggy about saying right, that to my exactly. son.
Of all that, she seems like, especially that generation, in the kind of tough broad that she is, that would have rolled off her back saying that.
You never knew. It was like sometimes she would say the craziest things.
And especially coming from, you're gay and you're out about it, so it's like it's coming from a writer who's, it just, right. Now how was, like, Tracy's a friend of mine, and, you know, he can be off the rails and then great, like, were there moments with him where it was just like a crazy Tracy funny moment of, like, sort of dealing with him on set, or, you know, and sort of working with him or getting him through it?
I love Tracy.
Yeah.
And he was, without a doubt, so fun and no ego. Like, Tracy would literally say to you, if he just wasn't getting it, he would look at me. If I was directing him, he would look at me and say, "How do you want me to say it, Reg?" He would just say, "Just tell me. Just give me line reading." He would just say it.
That's awesome.
He didn't care.
And he also probably had a lot of respect for you as a stand-up of yourself, right? Like, and sort of, like, I think there's always that camaraderie between an actor who's a stand-up and a director-writer who's a stand-up.
That was the nicest thing that he would do. Sometimes there would be... he'd have friends of his come, like a lot of his friends from the neighborhood would come and visit him on set. And I'd be walking on the set, and he'd be sitting outside. We had like a craft service table right outside, and he'd be sitting there with these people, and he'd go, and a lot, more than one occasion, he'd be like, "You know who that is? That's John Reggie. You know that dude?
That dude been doing stand-up forever, man. That's a legend. John Reed is a legend.
Not that I think I am a legend, but it was just nice of him to say
it. Yeah, no, but you...
And he was really, really sweet guy and was like... I loved working with him. I loved working with him. He was always funny. He was always... He would always do his work if he... You know, he had a hard time remembering lines sometimes.
Would he bring... Would he sort of... Would you, how much improvisation would you guys allow within the script? Or was that up to the director that week? Or the
well, we would try not to improvise it too much. We would improvise it if we thought of something better. But
that's
generally...
Kind of, that's
it
kind of ironic to me because, I mean, Tina comes from... You know, improv background. There's a lot of improv background people on the show.
Yeah, but we spent a lot of time writing it, and 30 Rock, if nothing else, 30 Rock was a very writerly show. It was very driven by writing.
So you come in with a script for, I don't know, the A story is Tina thinks she wants to adopt a child and just forget about being married, and then there's a B story with Alec and his mother, and a C story with Tracy trying to buy marshmallows, whatever. When you start with that story, you walk in with that script, help people understand sort of the process that that goes through and how much that changes as it goes through different hands on the staff, right? Like, you don't just walk in and go, here it is, and they tweak a couple of things and shoot it, or was that the case on the
show? No, what we would do is we'd sit in a writer's room and... 30 Rock was very much a one from column A, one from column B, one from column C show, in the sense that what we would do is at the beginning of every year, and it was kind of silly, is we would do these packets. You had to do a story packet. And so you'd have to write these story packets, and then the stories would... There was a gigantic board in the writer's room. And Robert Carlock and Tina would read all the story ideas, and then they would decide, oh, we like this one, we like this one. And that big giant board was divided up into Liz stories, Jack stories, Tracy stories, Jenna stories, the other writers' stories, Kenneth stories.
Oh, okay. So not necessarily A, B, C.
Right.
So just sort of...
So there'd be funny ideas for those stories.
And that's every week you had to come in with a...
No, at the beginning of the season.
Beginning of the season.
The funny thing about them was we very rarely used any of them until later on in the season when we were getting so far behind, we'd start looking at the big board and go, is there anything on the big board that we can use in the next...
Why wouldn't you use them initially? Because you just...
Because we would... For one thing, they wouldn't come in right away. We would do a thing where we'd sit down and talk about, let's talk about where we're going this season. Mm-hmm. And we'd do that for a week or 2 weeks. And things would start to get generated. And the thing that sucked about it is sometimes you'd have a story idea that would be wind up being very similar than something that happened that was talked about in the room, so you couldn't put it in your story packet. But we would spend a lot of time coming up with, What does Liz Lemon want this season? Like, where are we taking her? What does she want? Like, when we did the baby arc, when we did all those different things. So we'd come up with those ideas, and then we'd try to think of that kind of stuff. And then we would say, well, what's going on with Jack? And what's going on with Tracy? And what's going on with Jenna? And, you know, which is, you know, like, one example of that is how we decided to give Jenna... we gave Jenna Will Forte as a boyfriend, as a cross-dresser that was dressing up as her but was straight.
How did that cross-dressing angle come up? It just was so...
I forget exactly, other than I think the genesis of it was that we thought that someone who dressed up like Jenna would be the ultimate person that she would be attracted to.
It's herself.
Because it's herself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then we went with that, and then we were like, well, what if it's drag queen? And then we were like, well, what if it's drag queen, but he's actually straight? And, yeah. And then we actually went down to, God, I can't remember that drag bar we went to. That's on the east side. It's on 2nd Avenue.
Oh, that's a real bar. That was, yeah. That wasn't a, oh, wow. Yeah.
And I shot that episode, and it was hard shooting in that place. But we shot there.
So all the extras were real drag
queens. Yeah, those were all drag queens, real drag queens.
They all probably thought this is my moment, too, yeah. Right?
So, but that would be an example like stuff we would do. So we would look at the individual characters and decide that. So the thing that was extraordinary then about the show is that, you know, you have 21, I don't even think that, I think we had 20 minutes and change to tell our story, and we were running a main A story, a B story, a C story, and sometimes like a D runner.
Jesus.
So we were running like 4 stories in a 20-minute episode.
But it kept the pace. That really got you, had great pacing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did you, you flirted with the idea, the show flirted with the idea of Alex's character and Tina's character getting romantically involved. It seemed like once or twice close. Did you guys talk about it? And was there a reason that they never...
Well, Alec and Tina both, as people, were just like, no, we're not doing that. Like, they just had no interest in following that storyline. That's one big thing. The other thing was...
You mean because they didn't want to cap to kiss each other? Or because
I think they kind of felt weird kissing each other, and they were just like, is that really where we want to take this, and whatever. But the other reason we danced around it a little bit is because it never occurred to us. Like... The only,
really? As a viewer, I watched that.
The only reason we even heard... We just started hearing people saying, oh my God, the sexual tension between them is so crazy. Are they going to hook up? And we were like, what? It was just so not on our radar screen that it was just very surprising to us. And I don't think we knew...
I'll tell you, that's the funniest moments for me is when he would just out of the side of his mouth slam her with an insult when you think he was going to say something nice. Lemon, don't do that. You look like Jack Kennedy with a hole in his head. Whatever he would say to her.
Yeah.
It would just be like, bam!
Yeah.
And it just would make me fall off the couch.
Yeah.
And do those trinkets get sort of laid in or as the script is going on, those little precious moments? Is that Alex sort of ad-libbing at times? Or
no, he didn't ad-lib too much. We wrote him stuff. The thing that Alec did that was amazing... is we would write him insane runs, like a half a page of dialogue that was one speech that he'd have to get behind that desk. And he would say it so fast. Like when you watch
and get it
Jack's
right.
delivery, it's rapid fire. Like right. there's no pausing. There's not somebody thinking about the next word. It's just all coming out.
But that's because I think he thinks that's what that character
does.
Yes,
absolutely.
The guy like that who runs, it reminds me of working on Wall Street of these guys that I would work through, and it's be like, next, next.
Absolutely, but Alec was also aware of the pace of the show and was like, I need to keep the pace up, like because otherwise, if just on a time...
It wouldn't work in the motif of the show.
Yeah, in a time... But literally, in the structure of the time of the show, if I don't blow through this, if I don't literally blaze through the speech, half of it will get cut on the cutting floor because there just won't be time for it.
Mm.
So he became very adept at saying a lot of words and very, very difficult.
Mm.
I don't know if you ever saw, I was just talking about it the other night, that's why it's in my head. There was one little gag that we were doing when Jenna... And this is with Jane and Alec together, like in a little dance. Jenna was lying about her age.
Oh,
and he asked her a series of questions really fast. She was like, well, you know, Jack, I'm only 27, or I'm only, you know, 29 years old. And he was like, what year did you graduate? What was the high school? What was the thing? What was the high score of the thing? Who played in the World Series that year? And he was like, boom, boom. And they were just back and forth. Like, there was not a space between them because they were just going.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of that.
Yeah.
We did a lot of that.
And that was great for the writing. Oh, I know you have to go real quick. When you were stand-up, a story of, oh, this is great, this is what I should be doing, or a story where, like, what the fuck am I doing, I gotta stop, or, like, you know, funny or otherwise.
I will tell you the greatest story of when I was a stand-up, which was when I
Started in, you're from Chicago, thought about going to medical school, started doing stand-up.
Decided not to. Well, I decided not to go to med school, decided to do stand-up instead and moved to California.
You also might know him as the bank clerk in Seinfeld when they go to Hello, Hi.
I might know that.
It's a hi, hey, 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 yeah.
A hearty hello.
A hearty hello.
So, I did The Tonight Show. First of all, just doing The Tonight Show was the greatest thing. Without a doubt, was the greatest thing ever. Johnny. Meeting Johnny.
Yeah.
And Johnny came backstage to my dressing room after my first appearance and shook my hand and said, "We're going to see you again really soon." And I thought my head was going to pop off.
Wow.
But I will say that I did it two more times. On the third time was his last year that he was on. So he was being very specific about who he wanted back. And he asked me to come back and do a set. And I did my set. And I sat down.
Wow.
And I remember I sat down, and he said, and I had written this little bit that he did with me. He said, "How does this feel?" And I said, "It feels great." I said, I've practiced this moment 1,000 times in my brain, and it's really is just like this, except you're made out of cardboard." And then I did the rest of my jokes, and then which was a couple of things, and then we went to commercial. And when we went to commercial, and you have to be a real Johnny Carson fan to appreciate this, but he leaned over to me and he said, "You know, all three times you've been on, you take these enormously long pauses between your jokes. Like, you say a punchline, and then you just let it sit with the audience." And he said, "And the only other person I've ever seen do that is Jack Benny."
Wow.
And Jack Benny was his mentor.
Yep.
And he said that to me, and I said, "Wow, well, that's very nice of you to say." And he said, "You should keep doing that because it's really special and really unique, and you can pull it off."
Wow.
And I remember thinking, I'm ready for the sniper right now. I'm ready. They can put the beam right here on my forehead. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for doing this.
Thank you, man.
I hope everybody learned something about TV. That's a great Johnny Carson story.
Yeah.
That's a great Tonight Show.
He was a great man.
Yeah, it was nice that you got to do that and live that dream. A lot of people don't get to do it. Very funny, John Reed.
All right. Well, I gotta go. I got 8 feet to cover.
You gotta go walk over to your thing. What class are you going to?
Francais.
You go? Oh.
Oui, je parle.
Wait, Francais. What's this all about? Because you're going to France?
No, I just like, I want to take a useless language.
So wow, you're one of those guys that does that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
You're so sophisticated.
I know.
Little kid from Chicago. Look at you.
Très formidable.
I want you to tell another time that story about taking your mother to France.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great story. You want to tell it now? You got
to
go, right?
Really quick. I took my mom to France, yes. And I spent so much money. We stayed at the Plaza Atene. I got the room that Carrie stayed in at Sex and the City. So I spent so much money. And it was very much worth it. My mom's passed away since, and I'm so glad I did it. So I don't want it to sound weird, because we drank champagne at like 10:30 in the morning, and it was fantastic.
Magnum of champagne in the room, and he and his mother hammered it. Your mother's 81.
81 at the time, champagne. Yeah. We drank this and just looked at the Eiffel Tower, and it was really great. But then my mother, the reason this came up is because my mother, even though my mother had no money, did not come from money, she was not afraid at all of spending my money whenever possible. So I take her to the Plaza Atene. We're going to French restaurants. We're doing the same. I'm hemorrhaging money. And my mother says to me one day, I want you to take me to Chanel. And I was like, what? And she's like, you take me to Chanel. I want to buy a dress at Chanel. And I was like, are you out of your fucking mind? I'm not taking you to Chanel. And she's like, I want to go to Chanel. And just, I was so mad at her, because she just fucking guilted me into it. And just, I said, just us like stomping down the Champs-Élysées.
Like a petulant little
just
boy.
Me just going, God damn it. And then taking her to Chanel. And then she's like, I can't wear anything in here. And I'm like, yeah, of course you can. It's fucking Chanel. And you're 81 and you live in Cincinnati.
You're a good son.
I was.
Funny man. Thank you, John Regi.
Thanks, man.
All right, so that was John Regi. How great is that story about his mother? I love the part where he's just walking down the Champs-Élysées, just pissed as shit. Really, really funny guy. You have been seeing his work for a long time. If you didn't know it, now you do. Hopefully you'll be seeing his work again when and if my show gets off the ground officially and we start filming a sitcom for me, which would be crazy cool. All right, thanks for checking out the podcast. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com, for my new CD. And as always, appreciate you loving the podcast and keep spreading the word about it, people.